I'm sitting on the Cape with Stephen Place. My name is Laura Gray, and he has graciously agreed to participate in the Gift of Experience Oral History Project that we're having at the Boston Hemophilia Center. And it is September 14th, 2004. And Stephen has signed the consent form for full disclosure. So, Stephen, let me start by saying thank you.
You're very welcome.
And my first question is, just tell me a little bit about where you grew up.
Okay, I was born on September 26, 1954, Oak Bluffs, Massachusetts, which is on the island of Martha's Vineyard.
Wow.
Mom and Dad, Jan and Truman Place. One sister, Cynthia, she's older, lived on Martha's Vineyard for 22 years, all through grade school and high school and 4 years of college. And after that, I moved off of Martha's Vineyard to Philadelphia for a couple of years. And
what brought you to Philadelphia?
My girlfriend.
Uh-huh.
And we were married in Pennsylvania and moved back 2 years later to Cape Cod and have been here ever since.
So you've been married for?
26 years.
26 years. Now, tell me a little bit about when the word hemophilia came into your family.
I think my mom and dad found out I had hemophilia when I was 3 years old, mm-hmm. Running like any other normal three-year-old, and tripped and fell and hit my mouth on the corner of a table, and there's a little part that holds your upper lip up to your jaw, and that bled quite a bit. We were on Martha's Vineyard, of course, and there was a Dr. Gans who was from MGH, and he was the pediatrician, pretty specialized in hemophilia and that kind of thing, and he treated me, and they got the bleeding stopped, and that's when they brought me to Mass General and got tested and found out I had hemophilia.
Had anyone else in your family had hemophilia?
My mom's brother actually died of a tonsillectomy when he was 12, so that would have been in probably late 20s, early 30s when he died. Yeah.
Now, had he been diagnosed with hemophilia?
No.
So you're assuming that he died of hemophilia?
I'm certain that he bled to death.
He bled to death.
Mm-hmm.
And how about anybody else? Did any other family history come up after your diagnosis other than your uncle?
No, as far as I know, all my other cousins have not had hemophilia. I have a nephew that has hemophilia, and my sister's son, so that could carry it over for her. But she has another son that does not have hemophilia. So it's a 50-50.
Okay. All right. So tell me, when do you remember anything about this when you were three? Do you remember being flown to Mass General?
No, I don't remember. I don't remember anything about it. There were a lot of events in my life when I knew I had hemophilia. Probably the most significant was when I was 11, I had a pretty serious bike accident and still have the scar on my forehead to show. And
I can see it right in the middle.
Fell off my bike, no hands, and my head broke the fall. It was the first thing that hit, and had a huge lump. And that's kind of when things, when I was curtailed from doing contact sports, a lot of things that I couldn't do that I normally would do.
From that point on, you were curtailed from contact sports? And why from that point on?
Well, then I guess some of the doctors in Boston thought, well, I shouldn't be participating in contact sports. I wasn't a real sports nut. I always played baseball and played basketball and played, a little bit of football, but I was never a big sports enthusiast. So it was traumatic. That was probably a traumatic time when I knew I couldn't do things that I normally did.
So let me ask you something. From 3 to 11, did the diagnosis of hemophilia make any difference to your lifestyle?
It did a little bit.
Do you remember?
I remember, just being a little less active in sports than I might have if I didn't have hemophilia.
By your own choice or by someone's nervousness?
Well, Mom and Dad, Mom was very nervous.
Mom was nervous.
Yeah.
Tell me about that. Tell me about your parents. Who was the most involved in your care, or were they both?
They were both very involved.
Okay. Tell me about them a little bit.
Mom was a nervous person, as most mothers are, and she just wanted me to take things easy, but my dad was quite a bit more lenient. I always rode bicycles, and there wasn't a lot that I didn't do. I just did it maybe a little less than anybody else. I always knew in my mind that I had to be careful. And if I got a cut, I had to get a Band-Aid on it. Or if I got a bruise, I might have to sit and wait and not do things that I wanted to do.
You say your dad was more lenient than your mom. What do you remember about that?
Well, I had knives. Not okay. The thing, hemophiliac, but I had a pocket knife collection. I had tons of them, and I just loved it. And it wasn't it. My hemophilia was always said was considered borderline. Was always considered mild. A lot of these words that. It wasn't significant. If I cut my finger, I put a Band-Aid on it like anybody else.
So you had mild. Was it factor 8 or 9?
Factor 8.
Okay.
And it was just mild. And I just knew it was always... I didn't know any other way of life. In other words, when you have something like hemophilia, you don't know what it's like not to have hemophilia. You know, if you bang your knee or if you bang yourself, you're going to get a bruise. Okay, you got a bruise, so I have it for 5 days and someone else has it for 2 days. It never was a... It was just a way of life. It's just nothing... It's hard to explain.
So it's not something that was separate from who you were. It was just part of you.
Just part of me.
Uh-huh. Do you remember ever having feelings about your hemophilia? Like, did you, you know, in that it was part of you, did you therefore ever look at it and say, ugh, I wish this weren't, or I resent it, or...
Well, I did.
You did?
After the bike accident when I was 11, this tremendous... change in lifestyle, you know.
Why? What? Tell me about this accident.
I had a huge lump on my head. I mean, it was just massive. It was almost as big as an egg. And it was just right smack in the middle of my
forehead.
What
did they do? What was the treatment for it?
Well, the treatment was a compression bandage.
So they wrapped something around your head?
Wrapped an ACE bandage. And lie flat, aspirin.
No blood, no treatment that
no,
you remember.
Nothing whatsoever.
Just they wrapped your head up.
Wrapped my head up, told me to stay, you know, calm and lay down. There was a product, it was a plasma product. But I never got it. It was always in the refrigerator, but I never used it. So there was really no...
Were you in the hospital for any length of time?
Not at all.
Not at all.
Didn't even go. No, this was when doctors came to the house.
Okay, so the doctor came to the house.
Came to the house and said, yep, he's got a lump on his head. You know, we'll just put a compression bandage on it. And didn't know about aspirin being an anticoagulant then, so my head hurts. Okay, give him some aspirin. But I'm here. I survived.
You never had further complications, just that big lump?
The big lump. And then that was in August in 65, and I went to school in September. I mean, it was,
did you still have the lump?
I had a good sized scar. I just put a big old bandage on it and had raccoon eyes because all the blood drained down and went into my eyes. And
did the kids?
Yeah, you got a little teasing. Yeah,
you did.
Yeah, always had teasing. So
you did. What do you mean you always?
Well,
had
I was just always the smallest and I was always the littlest guy, and so the typical grade school stuff. You can do this later. Thank you. Yeah, I was always picked on, teased on. I was always the smallest, but that's all right. I survived.
What do you remember, actually, about that? Did kids call you names? Did they know you had hemophilia?
Well, they did, but it wasn't significant. It wasn't a big part of my life. It was just, I could almost use it as a crutch if I didn't want to do something.
Did you use it as a crutch?
Probably
you remember?
Did. I don't remember anything specific, but I could have. I mean, I could not get into the military. That was absolute.
But that's not forbidden. Using it as a crutch. That was just.
That's just part of life.
That was, was, yeah.
I never really made it to the physical or to the draft.
How come?
Because that was the year that they stopped it.
What were your thoughts about that?
Thank you, Lord.
Thank you, Lord. Yeah, okay.
Absolutely.
All right.
Because I didn't want to go. I mean, it just, you know, I mean, knew of guys that
died. For the Vietnam War.
The Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So. Just let me back up a little bit to your parents, because I'm interested in sort of the attitude that parents had mm-hmm. toward their kids
mm-hmm.
and how, at this point, you can look back and say, what effect did that have on me? You know, how did your parents talk about it? Did they talk about it? How did they treat you? What do you remember about that?
Well, I remember that they were always concerned if I got a cut or got a bruise. Okay. And they were both concerned. I mean, my dad, it's not that my dad wasn't concerned. It was that my dad, maybe he certainly didn't know it. He wasn't in medicine or anything, but he knew that, as, you know, some dads worry, moms and dads worry different levels. Mm-hmm. And moms are always worried about their children and, you know, whatever. And as a dad with my two daughters, you know, if they fall down, I said, come on, get up, let's go. You know, walk it off, that kind of thing. My dad was a lot like that. He would say, "You don't worry about it. Don't think about it a lot." And
so he wouldn't baby you.
No.
Mm-hmm. And your mom?
Yeah, she babied me a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what do you make of? Did that cause conflict between the two of them at all that you were aware of?
I don't think so. I think it caused conflict with my sister because I was the special one. The baby's always a special one to a certain extent, but I had the hemophilia, so the extra precautions or maybe the extra trips to Boston or. Kids are very, you know, protective of their territory and their rights, and it's not fair kind of thing.
Your sister's name was?
Cynthia.
Cynthia. So in what way do you think it bothered Cynthia? Do you remember?
Well, she always thought I was a special one.
Uh-huh. She would say that.
I would think she would say that.
Yeah. Today. Yeah. Would she complain to Mom and Dad about that?
Probably, yeah. You know, he always gets special treatment, or he always gets this, he always gets
that. What was that special treatment like for you?
That was great.
It was great.
Sure.
So you liked the attention.
I'm sure I did, yeah.
Yeah.
But I never wanted to be, you know, singled out and be the better one than her. That just would not be my nature.
Mm-hmm. Let me just go back again. You said, you know, I was a little more careful. Mm-hmm. Were you a little more careful?
Yes.
What do you remember about that?
Well, riding bikes. Once I fell off my bike riding no-handed, to this day, I do not take my hands off of those handlebars.
What scared you most about that bike accident?
Oh, the lump. The
because visually?
Well, it just, I mean, it was, you know, when I felt it, I got up and I went, ugh. You know, and I just...
just blew up.
Yeah, I just really hurt. I picked myself up and walked home, but... And I wasn't far from home. I was, you know, just down the street, but... I think when my sister screamed, I knew I was in trouble, so...
But did it hurt you, or was it just the visuals that was so scary?
Oh, it hurt. It hurt a lot. It's a lot of pain. I think in what I wanted to say, one thought that came to my mind, I think when I was after this lump, after this bruise, after this trauma, I knew that, I think it became at that point in my life, that's when it became significant. I knew that I have hemophilia and that I can get hurt. But I decided at that point in my life, and I really remember making a firm decision, that I was going to respect it, but I was not going to be afraid of it. I was not going to allow anybody to make choices for me. As much as you can as an 11 or 12 year old person, that I was going to be making choices about what I wanted to do, how far I wanted to venture into whatever area that I wanted to go.
I am fascinated by that. Tell me how you even came to that, or do you remember the process of, it sounds like there was a real epiphany at that point for you.
Oh, absolutely. I can't remember the day, but I can remember making a decision. I'm not going to let this make me into a wuss. I'm not going to live my life as not doing things that I want to do. If there's something I don't want to do, I'll use the hemophilia as a quote-unquote crutch. You know, if I didn't want to play football, because I really was never involved, really, you know, I really shouldn't do that. You know, obviously I couldn't be a boxer, obviously I couldn't be in the war or anything like that. So, that's...
I'm going to stop this for a minute.
Yep.
Anyway, I was saying that I was just fascinated by this event, mm-hmm. and how it was so apparently life-altering for mm-hmm. you. And you said to me, I can tell you more about that.
Well, it's I guess from that point on, from when I was very early teens, I decided to do my own thing, to be able to pick and choose and look at life and say, okay, there are certain areas where I'm not going to go, but there are so much more that I will go to, I want to be able to make my own choices.
Had you felt like you hadn't made your own choices prior to that, was it not an issue prior to that?
Maybe not an issue.
So it was the realization somehow that, wow, this is a real thing that I have here.
This is a I agree with that.
What am I going to do with it?
What do you mean?
In other words, how am I going to relate to it? How am I going to respond to this realization that I really have something that can affect me?
Well, I've just decided to be able to live life.
Right.
And not be afraid to cross the street or be afraid to ride a bike anymore or be afraid to do anything. But I know I have limits.
Yeah.
And if I cross the limits, then I'm going to get hurt.
What I mean is, I was being not clear. I think what I'm trying to understand is prior to that event, were you afraid of the hemophilia? Did you ever take it into account?
Oh, I did, yes.
You did?
Oh, sure.
Were you afraid of it before? Were you, you know what I mean? Was there a change in your, what was the change?
The change
from
was
before and after?
From the event of the head injury.
Yeah.
I had a lot of people telling me what I was going to do.
I see.
But then, whatever it was, a year later or something, I decided, I know my limits, and I'm going to go to those limits, the extreme limits. If I cross the line, I could get hurt.
I see.
And I'll pay the price.
So somehow that event made you step up to the plate to take responsibility for yourself.
Exactly.
And not just have your parents decide what was right and what was wrong for you.
Correct.
When they were deciding for you, do you remember, did you agree with them? Did you resent it? Did you appreciate it? Do you remember what it was like to have others sort of determining what your behavior was going to be?
Well, as a young child, I think you have mom and dad making your choices for you. You know, they let you make choices a little bit. You know, my mom and dad, I think my dad was the one that would be more apt to let me make a choice rather than my mom. Well, that's not really good for him. You know, it's, you know, we have to worry about the hemophilia, da-da-da-da. You know, I never really heard them talking about it. That's one thing. They kept things pretty much to themselves. And I'm sure my dad relented to my mom a lot of times. So.
Okay.
One funny event, he bought me a Swiss Army knife. And first thing he did when he came home was he went down cellar and took this brand new knife and dulled it on a whetstone, just dulled it right down to almost nothing. So the first thing I do is I put it up and say, oh, and it's so sharp. And that's absolutely what happened, because they reminded me about that. But they were, you know, they now see, my dad would let me have a knife, but it would be dull. So I'm not going to be cutting my fingers off and do that. So that's kind of the way that my dad would think that, you know, let him live, let him have a good life, let him enjoy himself, and don't coddle him.
So then you move on from 11 on, okay? Mm-hmm. And this is, at this point, as you said, I'm going to take responsibility for this. I'm not going to let it get in my way, but I'm going to be cautious as need be. Mm-hmm. You know, how did it, if in any way, play out as you got older, in high school, for instance, or into after high school? Did it?
Well, high school, I didn't do any sports.
Okay.
Specifically because of the hemophilia.
Mm-hmm. Did you have alternative interests in high school?
Well, I worked.
Okay.
I worked at a hardware store, and I just loved that. That was my passion. I just loved to do it.
Really?
Oh, just couldn't wait to it. The day I turned 14, I got my working papers, and that's the day I started. So I couldn't wait, and I loved it. And so I did a lot with my dad. My dad and I were like best friends. We always did things together. So and build and paint and went out on the boat, because we grew up on the vineyard, so we were on the boat every weekend. Or went fishing, clamming, quahogging, all kinds of neat stuff. And he was always there, and we spent a lot of time together. So that was very good. It helped me a lot. Helped me develop it to who I am today, because I always think about my girls and what would my dad do, you know, in every situation.
Would he talk with you ever specifically about the hemophilia?
Not really. No, it wasn't. I think he knew that I knew what it was, and to take it easy, and I knew my limits.
So then what happened after high school?
Well, I got into college.
And where'd you go?
I went to Cape Cod Community College for 2 years, got an associate's degree there, continued on to Western New England College in Springfield, got a bachelor's degree there, started graduate school at Plymouth State in New Hampshire. I went one semester, and that was I was done with school at that point. Through high school, college, I had fair amount of injuries, mostly knees. My knee would blow up, or I'd hit it wrong, and and then I'd have to sit for a week.
What do you mean you'd have to sit for a week?
Well, when the knee blows up, you just sit for a week and try to let it heal.
No medicine, no anything.
Not in high school, not in grade school, not in high school, and
no cryo.
Not in college, no cryos, no factor eight.
No nothing.
Nothing.
So you'd just bite the bullet and let the swelling go down.
The swelling go down.
Tell me about pain. What do you remember about pain?
Never really a lot of pain.
No.
No. Just boredom, and I can't stand sitting here. That's the hardest thing for me to do is to sit. I can't sit. Ever.
But you'd sit.
But I'd have to sit. And
So you knew what you needed to do to have...
Well, that's what the doctors would tell me to do. You got to sit. And my knee's all blown up, and I'm just going to sit until this thing gets better. And then it would get better, and then I'd be on my way.
So it'd take a week or so, as you remember?
About a week for a knee.
And how often would that happen in your life?
Not often. Not very often. I know that the first time that I got factor eight was 1981, when I had 1982, when I had a half a kidney out. And I got my first shot of factor eight. And and then I got a lot of cryos at that same time too, just so they could, you know, make sure it stayed healed and everything else. And the only thing I did get out of that was some hep C. No AIDS, which I'm very thankful for. And I had a factor company. It's called, it's down in Connecticut. Can't remember the name of them. One of the ladies there told me, she says, probably the reason that you didn't contract AIDS was because you grew up on Martha's Vineyard and there was no hematologist. There was no factor VIII readily available. She lost her son to AIDS because he was a hemophiliac. And you got, you know, oh boy, this brand new product comes out, and boom, we're going to give it to you, and you're going to be able to live life like a normal person. And no one knew about it, and it claimed a lot of lives.
What was that whole period of time like for you? Do you remember what you thought about it when you started hearing about it, knowing
about
that
about the AIDS?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I remember.
Tell me.
I remember when I heard about it, and it had to do specifically with factor VIII and everything else. And I waited and waited a couple of years, and then finally I decided to get a test, and I got the test.
So you waited a couple of years wondering?
Yeah. And then I waited, and then it was, I think I got the test on like in the middle of the week, and I called, you know, for the test results would be available, you know, on such and such a day. Well, the doctor was out of the office for the whole weekend, so I had this terrible, horrible weekend, or almost a week. It was horrible, just waiting. But he said, you're clean and you're clear, so... Of course, I didn't know about Hep C then either. So,
did having hemophilia affect your love life?
No,
not at all.
No,
was it an issue in your thinking? Will a woman want to marry me, or will this be an issue? Did
I
you?
I don't think so.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you tell your girlfriend and wife about it?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. What do you remember about that? Was it something you were worried about disclosing or not?
No.
Okay.
Not with my wife, no.
Okay.
Not with Carol, no.
Had she known about it? Did she notice it, or did you have to tell her?
Oh, I had to tell her. I have no physical signs at all of hemophilia at all. Nothing. I don't have any lines or any, you know, where I've been giving myself factor, you know, at all. I mean, it just, the only time I use it is as necessary, treat as necessary.
No limping, no really bad joints?
No.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. No.
When you married your wife, was there ever an issue of children or a discussion around that?
We talked about kids, and we knew that I was, you know, I had hemophilia, and that I could give it to my daughters as a carrier, and that their sons might have a 50-50 chance. They will definitely be a carrier because it's on that chromosome, and it's a 50-50 chance if they'll pass it on to their sons. But we know from all the doctors we've spoken to, it'll never be more severe than mine. And we know now that there are factor products that take care of it, you know, very quickly. And so,
what's your relationship with factor now?
As needed.
I
have a down cellar in our refrigerator, down cellar. And if I get a bump or a bang or a bruise or something I feel that's significant, I'll grab it, go to Cape Cod Hospital and say, here, this is how you do it.
Mm-hmm. You don't self-infuse.
I suppose I could if I had to.
But it's not something you've had to do that often,
I've
and
never,
therefore...
Never self-infused.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I imagine I could. I'm sure I could. I can do just about anything. Not afraid to do anything like that. So, I have, you know, syringes and the factor down cellar and that kind of stuff. But I carry a little thing in my wallet that says, you know, if I'm unconscious, the factor rate's at my house, get it. Get me to Cape Cod Hospital. Right away, and just I have a doctor. Also, have a doctor on hematologist on right here on the Cape.
So you do have a hematologist
right
now,
but I've only seen him once, just as an initial visit, and he's kind of there in my back pocket in case I need him.
How does your hemophilia affect you in life now, or does it?
I'm a little more careful than a normal person.
Physically.
If I'm doing something, I look at a couple of important points: head, knees, elbows. If I bump, bang, or something, you know, fairly good rap, I'll run right up and I'll get some of my Stimate, a couple of squirts, put it back in the fridge, and right back outdoors doing whatever I was doing.
So the Stimate is really something that's helped you?
It does. It brings my factor level up to 50%.
Okay.
That's what they tell me.
Right.
Which is great, which makes things heal a lot faster and be a lot less severe and a lot less downtime sitting and waiting. I asked Dr. Marks a long time ago if Stimate was something I could use every day, and he thought the, I don't know what the word is, but it would not be as effective if I used it every day. So
you use it on an as-needed basis?
Just as needed, yeah. If I'm going to go out and I'm going to be working, like I've been reshingling my roof. And what I do before, I do it preventively. I do it prophylactically. I'll just, first thing in the morning, I'll just put a couple of squirts in there, and I'll go out. And so I have that. When you have, as a hemophiliac, when you have that little extra, little less chance of being hurt, or a little less chance of a bump being significant, it's much easier to work because you're not worried about getting hurt. If you're not worried about getting hurt, you're more relaxed, you're less apt to get hurt. Do you understand that concept?
Mm-hmm.
When you get your seatbelt.
It's very freeing.
When you get your seatbelt on the car,
right.
You don't mind going down the road. But if you don't have a seatbelt on, you're going to be nervous and you're going to be looking around, and an accident is more likely to happen when you're nervous about stuff.
What about your daughters and the fact that they're obligate carriers, mm-hmm. is the terminology?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Do they know about it?
They know about it.
Yeah.
And they will... when it's time, you know, when they get married, they'll have to disclose that to their fiancés and say, you know, this is a chance. And they'd have to go on that way. But I believe, and I read a little bit in my Hemaware magazine, they are working on genetically engineering to be able to eliminate it. And I think in my lifetime it'll be eliminated.
Do you?
I sure do. Oh, they're doing other stuff, the medical science that's come out. Which is amazing.
Part of the reason I thought this would be a very interesting oral history to do is because when you were born, there was so little available,
mm-hmm.
you know, virtually nothing, you know, except for whole blood, really. And even then, and now there's this factor that can stop a bleed or a Stimate that mm-hmm. can, you know, protect you. Did you have that experience, particularly of ever wishing that, God, you could get rid of this faster, and now you really can? What has that changed your quality of life that you remember in any way?
Never thought of that. yeah, sometimes I wish I didn't have it, especially when I'm sitting down in a chair for a week with a bad knee or something. And but now, since the factor is pure, and if I did ever, you know, really, you know, mess up my knee, I'd get some factor into me. I'd have them leave that line in there, and I'd probably do it for 2 or 3 days. And then instead of being a week sitting down, I could do it for a couple of days. So that does make life, the quality of life, much better, knowing that it's there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it, in some ways, it's not as much of an intrusion.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Was it much of an intrusion on your life, actually, as a mild factor 8 person?
I suppose in some things, you know, there were things that I couldn't do. You know,
so it was more around what you couldn't do, you felt,
right.
than the fact that you'd have to sit around for a week.
Right. like I couldn't do sports. You know, even if I wanted to, I couldn't do it. So it was, my choices were a little bit more limited. Mm-hmm. But then I guess I made a decision. Well, that's okay. Maybe that's why I'm not such a crazy sports fan. It's because I never really could participate in sports for any extent.
Do you feel at all that, let me see, that hemophilia might have actually, do you think you made any gains from the fact that you had hemophilia? I don't mean got things, but psychologically.
Probably I'm still alive. Because when you're a teenager and you're crazy, there were times where I said, well, if I drink too much and I'm driving home and I get into a car wreck, I could really die, so maybe I'm not going to quite drink so much. So if I do, so I won't get into a car wreck. I mean, that's being pretty basic and pretty honest.
How did you become so reasonable, do you think?
What do you mean by reasonable?
Well, by this whole business of, I'm really going to take this into account versus, oh, I hate this thing and I'm not going to let it, I'm going to do whatever I want.
God made me, honestly, God made me this way. So I'm going to take what he's given me and make the absolute best I possibly can out of it.
So that's how you thought of it, that God made you this way?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Tell me about God and you. Is there a relationship?
Oh, a very good relationship. I'm a born-again Christian.
Uh-huh.
And came to faith in, actually my wife gave me the gospel, Jesus Christ as personal Savior, and I accepted him as my Savior. And even, this is back when I was 21,
okay.
22. And I always had a good relationship, I thought, with God, but this is a relationship with Jesus is much better. Really is. And from then on, just kind of dedicated my life to do whatever I can to serve him. And to know that, you know, there's going to be tough times. Just because you're born again doesn't mean that life's going to be a bowl of cherries. It's
tough. And how does your faith help you in tough times?
Well, because I can go to God. I can say, help me through this time. And he always has, every time. There's never been a time that God's let me down. Never.
Did you have this faith here at 21, you let Jesus into your life? What about before that?
Always had a relationship.
Always did.
Prayed. Yeah, from when I was very young. And knew that God was there and knew that God would help me. And always prayed. So
faith has played a very central role in your
life. Absolutely.
Did the faith make it easier to handle? Well, I imagine it makes it easier to handle any challenge.
Any challenge.
Yeah.
Still hard, though. Mm-hmm. There's still time. I'm a very impatient person.
In what way?
Well, like I don't like to sit around. I can't sit. I want to do everything now. Get everything done right away. And my theory is do today what you could do tomorrow, because when tomorrow comes, there might be something better to do.
Do you think having to sit with a swollen knee has anything to do with that?
Sure.
You do?
Well, because it just, when I had my half a kidney out, I was in the hospital for almost a month. Everything was fine, and I came home after 2 weeks and got a little bit too crazy trying to do something, and everything broke apart in there, and I had to go back in and get more cryos and sit for another 2 weeks. So I've always done that. Whenever I've had an injury, I've always tried to get back into it too quick and paid the price. I had a hernia operation and got back into it a little too soon, so it hurt for almost a year, and other injuries and stuff. So.
But you can have surgeries and have your bleeding managed now.
Yes.
Yeah.
With a factor.
Yeah.
Works well. I don't want any more surgeries. I really don't.
If one day one of your daughters, now you have two daughters.
Two daughters, yes.
And how old are they?
Stephanie is 16, Meredith is 20.
Okay. Is Meredith married?
No. Mm-hmm. Lives at home.
Okay. All right. If Stephanie or Meredith were to have a child one day who had hemophilia, what would that be like for you, do you imagine? Do you ever think of that?
I wouldn't hurt me.
Wouldn't
I'd
hurt
say,
you?
No. I'd say, let's go. This is just one little thing and we'll go through. We'll do. Also, I mentioned we have in our family something called neurofibromatosis. Are you familiar with that at all? Okay, neurofibromatosis is a genetic, say neurological disorder where it's a sheathing that's on your nerves. It's like a little electric. It's like a wire, like the plastic coating on a wire, well, it gets enlarged. Okay, and Stephanie on the right side of her face has a large neurofibroma on the side of her face. that's one thing that neurofibromatosis causes. I have little fibromas like all over my body, my neck, and these little things that just kind of, these little dots and these little things. It also caused a brain tumor in Stephanie when she was 4. It was in her thalamus, it was inoperable. Brigham and Women's had a brand new treatment called stereotactic radiation, where the radiation comes in instead of a brain bath for the entire head. It comes in and energizes when the two beams come together so they can treat a pea-sized tumor. And that was developed back, well, 12 years ago. So, we went through that. She's also, she just had some surgery on her ear because the fibroma closed up her ear canal, got so big. And Meredith had scoliosis, and she had, up at Children's, she had rods put in her back to straighten her spine. She also had a long bone in her leg that wouldn't heal. All these things that can be caused by neurofibromatosis, it's NF1. Because there is an NF2, which I don't have a lot of information on. So I have it, but the only thing effects that I've had are just these little fibromas around my body, which don't really slow me down too much.
Mm-hmm. So you've had to deal with a lot of medical stuff.
Yep.
And a lot of stuff that's been passed on.
Right. We made a lot of trips to Boston.
It sounds like it. It sounds like it. And have also benefited, it sounds like, from some real advances in science.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. What about healthcare professionals? What has your relationship been with them? Do you have any memories of growing up and having nurses or doctors or even social workers, anybody?
Well, there was Dr. Gans. It was this, he was up at Mass General. He was pretty important, pretty high up for MGH. He had a summer home on Martha's Vineyard, which is why we got to know him through a doctor there. We'd see him every couple of years or something, go up and give me a physical, and he was very stern, you know, one of these old stern type doctors, but a nice guy. And he would say, well, you know, I don't want you doing this, or I don't want you doing that, and I'd probably go home and do it anyway. But he was the one that probably had a lot to do with my early health care. Some of the local doctors on Martha's Vineyard were just general practitioner kind of guys, and they just kind of muddled through most of everything that happened. So.
Do you remember having a positive, negative? Does anything strike you as how people treated you back then or even now?
Well, a lot of people, you know, they hear hemophilia and they just automatically think the worst. Oh my gosh, you know, you don't want to bump or bruise him or that kind of thing. Then when I would explain to him, well, it's very mild, and it's not a real serious thing, and unless I'm in an automobile accident, unless I'm having surgery or something, then I need to really, be careful. So I thought of something also, and I knew you were coming. I've always had mild hemophilia, but I've never known anyone with serious hemophilia, so I really don't know what someone with serious hemophilia goes through. Even for me with mild hemophilia, it's hard for me to conceive of what they have to go through every day. Mm-hmm. You know, giving treatment, you know, factor every day, you know, I have to do this. It's like a diabetic, you know, every day they have to, you know, get some kind of medicine, because I hate taking medicine. You know, I'll take a Tylenol once a month, maybe, if
really?
That's it.
You're resistant, really, to taking medicine.
I'll just, you know, maybe a decongestant or something if I get a headache and that kind of thing.
In pain? Just sort of tough it out.
Tough it out, yeah.
Uh-huh.
The headaches, the sinus headaches are about the worst part of my life. So, mm-hmm. But they don't happen that often. So if I mm-hmm. treat them fast and get them going real fast, then I'll be fine.
Politically, were you affected at all politically with the whole AIDS crisis and the medicine? And gee, it was the medicine that gave no feelings about that.
No, I knew that it was, that AIDS was a very terrible thing, and just a very small percentage of the people affected with AIDS, it was 90% either illicit sex or illicit drug use, and that's where it came from. It was just rampant, and that the amount of people that were affected outside of that category were very, very small.
Mm-hmm. What about getting Hep C through the factor?
Well, that's when I first remember I was up at Boston Hemophilia Center, and I had blown out my knee for some reason or other. And they did some blood tests. They came back. Gee, you've got antibodies for Hep C. Okay, all right. Well, that just kind of was a thing. It's a non-A, non-B is what they used to call it before they made it Hep C. And so I knew about it and didn't really think a lot about it. And I saw a hematologist at Brigham. It was a Dr. Grace. That would have been back in 99. And he did some tests. He said, well, this level's good, that level's a little high, your count is very low. He said, you're probably going to die of something else other than hepatitis C. He was a very old school Dr. Gracer, I remember him. He was very good. And so I kind of ignored it for a while. And my regular, then I went to a gastro guy down in Hyannis and didn't really care too much for him, so I kind of ignored it for a while more, and see my regular GP, and he tests the levels every 6 months or something like that, and they're still pretty low. I did see another gastro kind of guy, a gastroenterologist, just recently, and my levels are still very low on that, and they said you could treat. It's genotype 1A, which means if you treat genotype 1A, you treat for 48 weeks. And you got a 50-50 chance. And it's, my brother-in-law went through it, and it's pure hell. My sister told me it was terrible. Terrible for him, and it didn't do a thing for him. Now my nephew, her son, also got Hep C from Factor. And he,
how old is he?
He, Adam, I think he's 28 or 29. Mm-hmm. And they say he got cured.
Really?
He was free.
Mm.
I don't know what genotype he was, but he did it. But he only did it for 20 something weeks, so couldn't have been a genotype 1. Now my brother-in-law got it from drug use back in his early days, back in his teenage years or 20s or something. So right now I made a decision I'm not going to do it.
Yeah. Now Adam has mild hemophilia because it's the same in the family. Has he ever come to you about it, or has it ever been?
No, we really had never really talked a lot about it. There was a time in our lives, as a lot of families have, where my sister was kind of apart from the family.
Okay.
So most of his younger years, but we're, you know, we talk on the phone once in a while.
Were you ever that interested in meeting other guys with hemophilia? Was that something you ever wanted?
No, never really thought about it.
Never really did?
No, I never really, it never was such a significant thing that I would join a care group or a thought group or, you know, one of those groups of, you know, when people have cancer or people have different things, they'll join a support group. And growing up on Martha's Vineyard, I don't think there may have been one other person with hemophilia.
But as an adult, it's not...
No, it's not anything I have any desire to do.
Yeah.
I'd like to help anybody I could.
In what way? When you
say
that?
Well, just my philosophy is to respect it, but don't be afraid of it. Respect the disease, but don't be afraid. Don't be afraid to do things. Be afraid to stretch yourself a little bit, stretch it right to the limit. And if you get by, great. It builds your self-confidence, builds everything up, builds your whole self-conscious and self-esteem. Build yourself right up.
You're saying do that?
Oh, yeah. Go to the extreme. Go, don't push the envelope too much, because then you're going to, don't do something stupid, because then you're going to get hurt. Then it's just, I've done things that are stupid. I'll show you my scar
okay.
Right there.
Oh, yes.
That's a good scar.
It's a scar right on your left hand.
I held a board, and I held a razor scraper that you clean your windows with. I needed to trim a little piece of wood. I could have gone down cellar and got the right tool. Would have taken me a minute at the most. But I held that thing there, and all I wanted to do was trim that little piece of wood, and I got a clear thought in my mind. Steve, if this thing slips, you're in trouble. And it slipped. So it was rushed to the hospital, get the stitch inside, just Mr. Notary, stitch up the outside, and I spent, again, a week in. And it hurt. So to save 60 seconds, I put myself out of commission for a week. Again, that was stupid,
do you think your father's attitude of encouraging you to go out and do affected your feeling like you could do things?
Oh, sure.
You do?
Oh, sure.
That attitude. Mm-hmm. Because oftentimes parents wonder, how careful should I be? How mm-hmm. protective should I be? How, you know, it's such mm-hmm. a hard balance. Do you have any mm-hmm. thought about that?
Learn your limits and go right to the limit.
Go to the limit. How do you know what your limit is?
Trial and error.
Okay.
And if you know, you get hurt, you say, well, next time maybe I won't do it, or maybe I'll do it a little different. I have power tools. I have every power tool in the world. I mean, I could, if I cut my hand with a power tool, I'm in serious trouble. Anybody who does is in serious trouble. But if I do, I've got that little extra bit of seriousness and a little bit. So I think before I do stuff. You know, mm-hmm. okay, I'm going to cut this board, and this part's going to go here, that part's going to go there. What's going to happen? What's going to be the end of this little adventure, this little thing that I'm doing here?
What is your work, Steve?
I'm a salesman for mm-hmm. Harvey Industries. We sell doors and windows, and you might have seen our signs, and we're quite big up in the Boston area. So I've been in this kind of business, the building materials business, for 25 years, and built most of my house myself. Most of the rough frame, the house part was done, but hung all the doors and did all the painting and all the trim work and all the painting and built the decks and the sheds. And
very impressive.
So I always wanted to do more than someone would.
All right, I've just turned over the tape, and it's tape one, side two, and you were just saying to me you always wanted to do more.
Do more.
Because of your hemophilia. What's that about?
I don't want to be held back by it. I probably always wanted to live a normal life, but with that little thing in the back of my mind. Well, okay, how are you going to accomplish this, even though you have hemophilia? Do you want to go up on the roof? I'm just a little more careful. I'm not a little bit crazy. I have to say, okay, Steve, if you fall, then it's gonna take longer to get the roof done. Because you know you're gonna get hurt, then you're gonna get better, then you're gonna have to go back up there. So
hemophilia, in fact, even though it's been mild, has been a real entity in your life, a real relationship that you've mm-hmm. had to negotiate.
It's there every day.
It is there every day.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I use a electric razor.
Yeah.
I used to use a blade, but every once in a while I cut myself and said, ugh. This is such a pain. Now I got to slow down, and now I can't run right out of the house. So I just said the electric razor does a lousy job, but I say, okay, I'm going to use the electric razor twice a day rather than use a blade once a day, but I'm not going to get cut. So that's one little cut that I don't have to deal with, and I don't have to mess around. And so.
Mm-hmm. All right, I'm going to ask one other thing, and that is the whole idea of normal.
Mm-hmm. Can you put that on pause for 1 second?
Yeah.
Yeah, I need to.
Stop for a minute, and I was mm-hmm. saying to Steve that you wanted to live a normal life. You know, what does normal mean to you? Were you not normal because you had hemophilia?
I guess I just had to take extra time, or I had to be a little more careful.
Okay. But the whole concept of I am normal or I am not normal?
That's not really. I want to be able to just keep on going. I don't like to waste time.
Okay.
Time is very important to me.
So you didn't feel somehow that you were abnormal or...
No.
Okay.
Yeah. That was just me. And I had to do things that other people didn't have to do. And I couldn't do things that other people did. But that was who I was, so...
Yeah.
Just deal with it and make the best of it.
All right. Steve, have I not asked you something, or when you knew this oral history was going to happen, were there any thoughts that I have not tapped into or any memories?
No, I think I told you about everything, because, you know, the concept of you know, pushing yourself to the limit, but being careful, being aware of aware and respecting the disease, but just don't be afraid of it. Don't be afraid that you can't do something, because there are a lot of things that people can do, especially with a factor they people with hemophilia can probably, people with serious hemophilia can probably do more than I can do, because I'm not being treated and I still have that, whatever that magic number is, 25% or 30% of factor. There are probably things they can do that I can't, but that's okay. I'm not going to be infusing myself with hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of material that I don't really need. I can manage my life and do 98%, 99% of what I want to do. I can't really think of anything that I'd like to do. Maybe I could twirl knives or something, I don't know. But I do everything, I do everything that I want to. Very comfortable, very happy with what I do.
Well, I want to thank you then.
You're very welcome.
I so appreciate your putting aside this time for the Oral History Project, and it's been marvelous meeting you and talking to you.
Great talking to you too.